Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, gay Olympic gold. That and more next. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gordep of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, a split show. Later on in the hour from the archives, Gay Olympic Gold, my interview with Mark Tewksbury, public speaker, recipient of the Order of Canada, and Olympic gold medalist. We'll talk about all of the above and so much more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. But first up, a queer artist spotlight with Canadian queer recording artist Corey Stewart, who joins me to talk about his latest release, Take All My Toys and Go.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
In line, you're not the sharpest in the shed. All of the cards are in my deck, so play with someone else instead. Just thinking about this poison taking space up in my head, and I keep going back for more. You're not a friend, you're just a threat. Now you got me drinking, trying to drop dead. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's my own fault, hit the asphalt. You're no longer by my side. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die.
Corey Stewart, hello, hi, how are you? How
can I? Hi, Mark, I'm great. How are you doing?
I am well. Thank you for returning to Rainbow Country. You and I first met in person back in the day, pre-pandemic, when you joined me in studio at CIUT FM in Toronto, and we had a great conversation chatting, talking about you, and you. Here in 2025, let's talk about you, but a new record that you have, Take All My Toys and Go. Take All My Toys and Go. Talk to me about the sonic landscape of this new record. What can audiences expect sonically from Take All My Toys and Go?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back. I'm so appreciative. I love your program. And also, I have to tell you, and I'm sure the audience agrees, that your voice is the most soothing thing in the world. And every time I hear you, I'm just like, I get zent. It's okay. Like the best. I love it. Anyway, so with Take All My Toys and Go, this album is a pop album at heart, but it deals with themes of grief as well as themes of sort of dealing with being hurt and feeling betrayed and a bit lost, and then coming back from that and figuring out how to grow and how to really take ownership over your own faults and sort of make sure that you're being accountable to yourself.
So all that being said, what inspired you to create these new songs that would make Take All My Toys and Go? What inspired you to write this new material then?
So my first album, it was called Tove, and that is the namesake of someone one of my best friends that I lost during the pandemic. And with that, a lot of grief, obviously. And really I've lost grandparents, and of course that's difficult. But when you lose someone ahead of schedule is the best way to put it, someone who's young, and you're not prepared for it, it's a different kind of grief, in my opinion, because it's just like out of nowhere. And with that came a lot of sort of working within myself. And then after the dust settled, I had a lot of emotions and I had a lot of thoughts and feelings that really needed to be conveyed into song. And on top of that grief, I actually toured the US in 2023. And that was, to say the least, a huge challenge. And there were friendships lost. There were a lot of different conflicts. And, you know, with every sort of bad thing that happens in your life, generally, that is sort of the catalyst for great arts, at least in my opinion.
So touring the US then in 2023, why was it challenging for you?
I think people were not as open to going out as they were pre-pandemic. So in terms of basically what we did is two of us went to seven different cities across the East Coast. And in each city, we had two local artists, all queer, and with a priority on...
And you're talking about quarantine.
Yes, yeah. So all queer people and a priority on trans and BIPOC individuals, because we wanted to make sure that we're really giving a spotlight to people who may not have been given that opportunity in the past. So that was a real priority for us. But, you know, when you do these tours, you can't, as an indie artist, charge more than, you know, 15, 20 bucks tops at a concert event. And then you have to rely on that income of people, and then you're splitting it across four different artists. And not only that, but you have to count in all of your travel costs, your hotel costs, your promotional costs. It's a whole beast. And I think tours in general for indie artists are next to impossible these days because of all of those things. And the stress of that can challenge the strongest of friendships. And I think that was really what did it, you know? Mm-hmm.
So Take All My Toys and Go was co-produced by yourself and award-winning producer Gavin Bradley, who's worked with the likes of Nelly Furtado, Tori Amos, Jane Siberry. Gotta love Jane Siberry. How do you and Gavin Bradley, how did the two of you originally meet?
Okay, so get ready for a name drop. I was speaking with my friend Simone Denny, and she is the lead singer of Love Inc. For those who are familiar with their oeuvre of amazing songs, and Simone also has some great songs on her own as well. But
and she's a platinum selling artist.
Canadian goodness, she's her voice is insane. She's one of the most talented people I know. So she had recommended, after me speaking with her about, you know, wanting to pursue recording, Gavin. And from there, I reached out to Gavin. We had a good conversation. And the rest is history, really. I've worked with him on absolutely everything I've done since the beginning of my recording career, which was 2018, the start of it. Hmm.
So this album focuses on vinyl, of all things. You have a vinyl release as well. Talk to me about choosing to release this on vinyl, especially in this ever increasing streaming era that we are in.
Yeah, well, I think I guess over the past year and a half, I've fallen in love with vinyl personally. I find that it sort of forces you to sit down and listen to a full album, which is a real lost art. And we're seeing a resurgence in vinyl records as a whole, because people are sort of sick of that attention deficit problem we all have with, like, okay, I've heard 30 seconds of a song, I want to hear the next one. And you skip through things. And also, the corporate structure of Spotify and all of these other streaming platforms, it's unsettling and, in my opinion, can be a detriment to some of the music industry's progress. So vinyl felt like a really great decision because it was a way to make sure that people were able to listen to my album in the long form, in its full context. And also, it's just nice to return to a format that feels analog, you know? Mm.
So let's talk about the release of this album, Take All My Toys and Go, and the fact that it's being documented for a potential upcoming project. I'm assuming it would be a documentary, like a behind-the-scenes documentary, maybe?
Yeah.
Can you fill us in on what you can about the filming of the release of this album?
Well, it's warts and all. Corey Stu warts and all. But it's basically just sort of showing the behind the scenes of releasing this album and, you know, all the work that goes into actually putting something like this together, distributing it, getting people to pay attention, and really sort of a behind the scenes look at what it is to be an indie artist in today's world. And the struggles behind it, you know, because I think it seems pretty from the outside of varnished appearance of what you can expect when you see someone doing music for a profession. But then when you peel back the curtain, there's so many things that I don't think you realize that are happening in the background. And there's a lot of struggle. There's tears. There's you know, all of this work that goes into making this sort of thing happen, and money, by the way. Not that I'm complaining at all, because it brings me such immense joy, but I think that
you can't buy food with joy.
Well, Mark, you have a point.
Please, Mr. Grosser, can I pay you with some joy?
You know, it's funny.
Behind the counter at night.
So you bring up an Oliver reference. It's so funny. One of the songs on the album, Worst Enemy, I do say, please, sir, can I have some more? yeah, so I wanted to sort of show that part of the journey, and we're putting it together. It's going to be a short sort of thing. I would imagine something under 20 minutes. And the hope is that we can submit it to Inside Out Festival and potentially, you know, have some legs there. So that's what the plan is.
So what are some of the struggles that you've been dealing with being an indie artist and putting out a new record in 2025, a vinyl album as well, and promoting this, getting this out there, getting, you know, streaming, getting radio airplay? What are some of the biggest struggles that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, I think really one of the things is, like, how do we get people to even give a, you know what, about it? Because it's such a saturated market these days. Anyone and everyone can make music. And that, to me, makes me very happy, because I think that everyone should have the opportunity to do that if they feel it in their soul at any level of, you know, expertise. If someone feels they need to express themselves, I love it. And I'm so happy that people have the outlet to do that now. On the other side of it, because there's so many people who are able to do that, it's very hard to, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear? So promoting is always a challenge, figuring out interesting ways to sort of perk people's interest. One of those things was doing two listening parties when the album was released, basically going through the entire album with an audience and explaining each of the songs and sort of what the production was like behind it, what the thought process was, how this, how the lyrics were built out and all of that sort of thing. And that was very fruitful, because not only did we get some good press with it, we also got a wonderful chance to engage with people and to really connect. And that's something that my last album, I wasn't able to do as much because it was released in 2021 and we were still, spoiler alert, in the pandemic. And, this time I really got the chance to share the album and see other people respond to it. That has been such a beautiful thing.
So in the process of getting this new album out, as well as being an indie artist, you're also part of the LGBT community. And has that come into play at all in regards to who you might work with in regards to, you know, promotionally or a gig that you might have at a particular club or what have you? Has being part of the LGBT community, being a gay artist, has that been a help or a hindrance to you?
I honestly think it's been a help. I think that the people that I've dealt with, and even some of my collaborators, like Gavin identifies as queer. The other person featured on the album is named Michelle Mondesir, and she's on a song called Don't Want to Die with a Broken Heart. She's part of the queer community and also has a wonderful band named Madam Psychosis that is incredible, and they're always playing in the city, so check them out. And also I have a collaborator in Victoria, BC, named Kelly Fleming, who is also queer. So in a way, it's been awesome to be a queer artist because we can work with each other. And I find our community is so effective at creating opportunities for ourselves, because for so long, we've not been given them. So we just sort of make things happen. And I think that that entrepreneurial spirit is shared through a lot of the queer music community. And that really is such a warm and wonderful feeling. And I think even the queer art industry has been sort of has been in that sort of way. And I think you can relate to that as well with you being in the industry. It's, you know, we sort of make these things happen for ourselves and we work together because we can count on each other, you know?
So in 2022, you and Kissos, I think it's
Kissos. Yes. Yep.
The two of you won the 2022 Wavy Awards for the, you were talking about this earlier, the Quarantine Tour.
Yes.
Congrats on that award and winning
that.
Thank you. First of all, what does that award mean to you?
It meant a lot, to be honest, to be sort of recognized, because the two of us, our real goal was to make opportunities, like I was just talking about, for the queer community and the queer music community specifically. And being recognized for that, although not expected, or like, you know, we didn't apply for it or anything, which, spoiler alert, I'll say it again, most awards you do have to apply for. Like, it's just a reality of getting an award. It was out of nowhere, and it was such a compliment because it felt good to know that it was being seen, you know, that we were actually making impact. So it was wonderful.
And the Quarantine Tour, can you give us a bit of insight into what this was all about, essentially?
Yeah. So during the pandemic, we couldn't perform. We couldn't, there were no ways to really make money. If you were like an artist. So what we did was we started an online TRL style show called Quarantine. And basically it just allowed us to feature either performances, music videos, or whatever anyone wanted to present in visual form. And we would air it, give only positive commentary because we wanted to make sure it was coming from a place of positivity. And that sort of evolved into, well, wait a sec, we should take this on the road and use these, not use, that's a horrible word, but like feature these artists that were on Quarantine in different cities where they live. And both of us just took that upon ourselves, organized, we hooked up with a booking agent for a tour, and then made it happen, essentially. And it was sort of all happenstance, but in the best way. And we were lucky to be able to do that. And it, to this day, is one of the biggest learning experiences of my life. And also, you know, when I look back, I'm really proud of the fact that we were able to do that.
Do you think that you would do something like that again, maybe in a different way or different format or somehow? But do you think that that is something that you would try to mount again?
I loved being on the road. Most people say they don't. I absolutely love going from city to city, waking up and like, you know, exploring a place and then performing at night. Like, it was a joy. I would love to do that again. I think it's a lot of organization and it's a lot of details. So if I did it again, I would want to have a big team of people to help. That would be probably clutch. But, I mean, if the cards were in the right place, I definitely would, yeah.
For sure. So your 2021 debut album, Tove, T-O-V, reached number 9 on the iTunes pop charts. Congrats on that, especially being an indie artist. How does that make you feel, being an indie artist, being a queer artist, and going top 10 on iTunes?
It was insane, Mark. I totally did not expect it. And in fact, I wasn't even looking for it that day. I was just, you know, it's a release day of an album, particularly your first one. It's so exciting and you're sort of just like living in the pure bliss that something you've worked on for years is out there. But then someone messaged me and was like, hey, did you know that you're charting on iTunes? And as the day progressed, like it started, you know, 50. And then it went to like 38. It kept going up and up and up. And I was just like flabbergasted. But at the same time, like, wow, it was amazing.
Wow. Well done to you. So here's my last question for you. The title for 2025's new release, Take All My Toys and Go. Take All My Toys and Go, this particular title, there has to be a story behind this title. And if there is, what is it?
For sure. So when I was a kid, growing up in Woodstock, Ontario, at the time, Woodstock was not as progressive as I would say it is now. And with that came a bunch of challenges. And one of those was, you know, every single day I'd get ready for school, and I was a really chubby kid. And when I say chubby, I mean severely overweight. I would get ready for school and then walk to school. And as I was entering school, I would get called a fat F slur. And I would constantly get it on the way into school and on the way out of school every single day. And it's really weighs on you, I think, when it's like just, you can't even start your day without, you know, going through that. And I'm sure many of us can relate to this because it happens still today to kids all across the country and the world. And then one summer I decided to, you know, I decided I couldn't change the fact that I was gay, but I could change being overweight. So trigger warning, I did starve myself and develop sort of a disorder where I was becoming someone who was not eating a lot. I dropped a severe amount of weight, went to school, and now instead of being called a fat F-slur, I was just called an F-slur. And for me, it was sort of taking my power back. But at the same time, it was sort of like, well, you're not going to ever please these people. You're never going to get their approval. And by the way, what does it matter what their approval means to you? So Take All My Toys and Go is sort of an allusion to that, alluding to that and saying, you know what? I don't care. I'm going to take all my toys and I'm going to go where I am going to be loved, and I'm going to take my power back and I'm going to be me. And that's essentially sort of the crux of what all of it is about.
Mm. Wow. Powerful, powerful words.
Yeah.
Corey Stewart, well said, well done, well recorded, well made, well vinyled, well pressed. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. I always love talking with you.
Take All My Toys and Go is available wherever you get your favorite music, as well as being on your favorite streaming service. For even more on this artist, simply visit CoreyJStewart.com. By the way, in hour two, I'll be featuring a three-song Corey Stewart set. Up next, Gay Olympic Gold.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
So, I wanted to take this time to let you know about the next evolution of Rainbow Country, simply called Rainbow Country Plus. Streaming 24/7 on YouTube. It's currently live, and to check it out, simply head over to marktara.ca, where of course everything's connected. and hit the poster. It's right there, it's simple, and of course, it's free. And currently features interviews from filmmakers that have been part of the Toronto International Film Festival that have had the honor of interviewing. So I hope you'll take a little time and check it out. Rainbow Country Plus, the next evolution of this little gay radio show.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Mark Tewksbury, hi, how are you?
I'm great, Mark, how are you?
I am well. It is a pleasure to chat with you, to talk with you, even if it's virtually. So thank you for being here, to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So for his excellence in athletic excellence, sport leadership, championing equity, inclusion, and human rights, both on and off the field. On November 27th, 2020, you received the Order of Canada. Congrats on that.
Thank you. Yeah, it was made a companion. That's actually the highest rank within the order. There's only 165 living Canadians at any time can be a companion. So not only into the Order of Canada, but I didn't realize there were different ranks, and they really gave me the most incredible honor by making me companion.
And how does that feel?
It felt beautiful. It felt really, I don't know, you know, my whole life has been kind of but the road less traveled. I had to often leave institutions and hold a light to them and, you know, come out or do something to kind of raise awareness to issues. And it wasn't a very logical path to being recognized by the crown or your country. But it's pretty cool that in 2021 or 2020 that happened. And I think I'm one of the few people in there that's openly gay and recognized for my work as a sportsman and, of course, as a human rights activist. So it's really nice. It was very, very touching. I cried a lot, I have to be honest. I just kind of, because it was such a shock. Like,
how did you find out?
They call. So the Rideau Hall calls and they you have to accept. It's very formal. You know, a lot of people much younger than I have gotten the Order of Canada. And so I kind of thought maybe I'd never get the Order of Canada. It was just one of those things. I didn't get it. And then to get it and learn about the companion and get the companion, it's like, what? It's like, I guess it was worth the wait.
And so is there a difference between the Order of Canada and the companion Order of
Canada? Yeah. So the Order of Canada has three ranks within it. If you're a member, there's been about 4,500 members in Canada's history since 1967. The next rank is an officer, and there's been about 2,000 officers since 1967. And then the highest rank is companion. And as I said, you can only have 165 living Canadians at any one time, and there's probably been less than about 500 in our whole history. So I'm the only Summer Olympian except for Dick Pound that's in there. So it's really, it's like, what? So yeah, most people don't know. And the way you can tell is the post-nominal. So you'll see people with letters after their name. CM is a member, OC is officer, and CC is companion. The other way is you'll notice I'm wearing, oh, well, for your listeners, you'll have a snowflake-looking pin that's on the lapel or the left side of somebody's clothing. And that usually is the Order of Canada. And within it, there's a maple leaf. And if the maple leaf is silver, the person's a member. If it's gold, the person's an officer. And in my case, I've got a red maple leaf, and the red represents the companions.
Wow.
Yeah. So most people have no idea about that. I myself, until I became a part of the Order of Canada, was not aware of all of this either. So kind of my mission to educate people a little bit.
Well, thank you for educating me.
Pleasure.
You are known as an Olympic champion, especially in swimming. Now the order, a recipient of the Order of Canada, companion. You're also known as a public speaker and as a coach yourself and Debbie Meir, who is a silver medalist in synchronized swimming at the 1971 Pan Am Games. The two of you have created the Great Traits Corporate Companions, the corporate champions program. What is the Great Traits Corporate Champions program all about? Talk to me about this.
Well, it's super. It's like one of the most unique leadership training programs in the world, I think. And the reason I say that, it's unique for a bunch of different reasons. One is we look at this notion of leadership from three different points of view with three different courses of action. So how to lead yourself, how to lead others, and then for ongoing success. So those three things come together. We also train leadership like we train athletes to win the Olympics. And we really realize that the pursuit of athlete success and the pursuit of business success are incredibly similar. And they actually, they center around the pursuit of high performance, of getting better results, of improvement, of betterment. And so instead of training leadership, we train people in the traits of high performance. And after 12 weeks of going through our fairly rigorous, very simple, but very action-oriented, rigorous program, people emerge as leaders that can literally tackle any challenge that's thrown at them. But we need them for 12 weeks, for 3 months, and that's where the learning and the magic happens.
And is this part of the Olympic committee at all or anything like that?
No, this is my business. So this is how I earn my living. All of the Olympic stuff, it's all volunteer. So that I get to do for free.
Wow. Wow.
But certainly, I mean, my Olympic experience, Debbie was my coach. She kind of developed this framework in a way and then transferred it to my sport and then transferred it to other sports and then other businesses. So it's been really exciting. I mean, I think this is really homage to Debbie and her real insight and her ability to just get the best out of people. So it's really nice to be part of the business with her. We've been together for over 30 years as friends, colleagues, and now business owners.
Do you think that at some point this program will be able to be accessed by regular people, like just the average Joe wanting to improve themselves?
Absolutely. Yeah. Right now it's I'd call it maybe a bit of a boutique product because there's only so many classes every year. It has to be done at certain launch dates, but we're going to fully digitize what we're doing in the upcoming year. And so that people can start this journey, their 12 weeks, whenever they would like. Won't be quite the same. It'll be a slightly different version, but absolutely the learning will all be the same. And the pathway that you'll follow, the framework will still be the same.
I can see this being something that you guys offer on PBS, you know, how they have those those programs that, you know, self-improvement.
Even better, we'll do it on YouTube. That's the new PBS.
True, true. So let's dive into the pool. So Commonwealth Games champion, Pan Pacific champion, world champion, Olympic champion, two Olympic Games, 1988, 1992. Here's the question. When did you first discover swimming?
So I started swimming when I was about five because my parents lived in Dallas. We were transferred from Calgary. My dad worked for an oil company as a junior accountant. And then I watched the 76 Olympics on TV and I was 8 years old. And we had the kind of success that, you know, we've seen in Rio and Tokyo with the Canadian swimmers, lots of medals. So I got really excited. And that's when I joined a swimming club. And when I was about 10 to 12, I started to like show real promise. Then from about 12 to 15, I struggled a bit with hormones and growing, et cetera. And then I kind of found my way again and made the junior national team by the time I was 16, and the rest became history.
Well, in 1988, at the Seoul Summer Olympics, you won silver in the 4x100 meter medley, the medley relay. Mm-hmm. When you were at your first games in 1988, what were those games like for you?
They were very overwhelming. The idea of going to like see an Olympic city before you compete there is actually more of a current idea. Back then, I'd never been to South Korea. I'd never been to Seoul. So just being in that completely different climate of Asia was, first of all, surprising. And the Olympic Village is, especially in the summer, it's quite extraordinary. It is literally like a city within the city. And you're surrounded by, you know, thousands of the world's best athlete specimens from all different countries and shapes and sizes, depending on the sport. And I was just incredibly distracted. I was just kind of, and I did not have a great Olympic, I had a good Olympic experience. I didn't have a good Olympic swimming experience. I really soaked in all the Olympics, but yeah, it was overwhelming and distracting. And so that was great though. When I went to my second Olympics in Barcelona, that did not happen. First of all, I went to see Barcelona, the city, early. I felt very comfortable in that city, which was, I think, a really good omen. Just as a side note, I continue to go to Barcelona to this day for holiday. So it had nothing to do with winning the Olympics. I even forget that I won the Olympics there. I've been so many times for holiday. So I was able to really change that first experience to the second one.
So back in 88, was there a plan, whether it was maybe it was verbalized or whether it was maybe in your mind, was there a long-term plan that this 88 was going to be your first games, but you were going to go to 92 as well?
No, I was a medal favorite tracking before 88. There was this real huge innovation in my sport. An underwater dolphin kick was added, and you could go as far as you wanted underwater. I was terrible at it, so I fell down the world rankings. No, I didn't even have a plan for how I was going to swim my race in the ready room right before the race. Like, I was totally lost. I just can't even say it enough, because I was sure, you know, like the Russians and some of the great swimmers of the world would not adopt this new start because they were old school like I was. And when I got to the Olympics and I saw even the Russians swimming, you know, the whole half a length of the pool underwater, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm in so much trouble. So yeah, I had a lot of failures at that first games, and it was intended to be a success.
So those games were quite the games. There was Ben Johnson, who was your team member, Team Canada, and he won the 100 meter, but then got disqualified because he tested positive for a banned substance. Did you know, or do you know Ben Johnson at all?
Not really. I mean, I was on a couple of teams with Ben, but no, I not really. But of course, his persona and who he was at that time was larger than life. You know, he was the superstar of the team. I was just one of however many hundreds of people that went Seoul, but he was truly one of the biggest stars in the world at that time.
And what was the atmosphere like when everything sort of imploded around him, so to speak, in regards to Team Canada, 88 Team Canada?
Well, I was lucky because I was finished competing. So, I mean, I just think it would have been such a huge distraction. And I know, you know, Debbie and the synchronized swimming team, they had to really keep their focus of attention because they came after that and remarkably won two gold medals with that sort of circus going on around them. But it was, I remember when he won, I remember, you know, being in the Olympic Village and hearing just a roar from the Canadian delegation. It happened to be the same day I swam on the relay in the evening, so I was trying to rest. And so that was exciting. And then I remember it was something like from hero to zero in 8.6 seconds were on sheets 2 days later when it was taken away. And it was so surprising. We thought Russians and East Germans doped, but we just were a little naive in ever holding that mirror up to ourselves.
Then there was Greg Louganis, who won 2.8 two gold medals in that game after hitting his head on the 3-meter springboard. Do you know Greg Louganis at all?
I know him. I know Greg very well. Yeah, I got to know him over the years, especially around 2015. We were both inducted and we both received some awards at a couple different places, actually. So our paths crossed, and it was great to get to know him.
Is it fair to say that those 92 games changed your life?
Yeah, that would be fair to say. Yeah, I mean, I like talking about swing is kind of weird for me because it's not really part of my life anymore. It's just wonderful that I had that early experience in my life. But I think my life's been so much more interesting even after. And I think I've been able to do more. And I think the platform of winning the Olympics probably gave me, you know, much more amplification of messaging, and probably was one of the reasons I came out. You know, if I wasn't an Olympic champion, I don't think people maybe would have cared as much, but it made a big statement in 1998 when I did that. So it shaped my life in so many ways.
You were also on the cover of Time magazine.
Yes, that's true. I had a line of clothing at Sears. I had a book deal with Penguin. Like it was a big deal. But you know, in those days, it was not fun to be me. I was a closeted sport jock. My whole world was homophobic, and they didn't even know it. You know, it's just the way of the culture, and it's boys' club, and it's homophobic slurs, and it's locker room banter, and hiding who I was, you know, it was torture. And so it's interesting. When I had such big success and maybe the most access to wealth in a way, I never felt worse in my life. And so it was a great lesson for later in life, the correlation between money and success and happiness. But at the time, it was very difficult, especially feeling out of touch with my values. Like I was kind of lying and didn't have integrity, and that I couldn't be, you know, afraid for my livelihood. And of course, wanting to still be successful financially, et cetera, and seeing what people like Greg Louganis and Martina Navratilova and even Billie Jean went through when I was like 13, 18, 20, watching them be severely punished for coming out in the public eye, receiving no endorsements or losing endorsements, et cetera. So there was a lot at play back then. It's interesting now how quickly we can forget that history. It's been just 30 years ago, but the world was a very different place.
Well, let's talk about Marc Leduc, silver medalist at the Olympic Games in 92, your Team Canada teammate. The two of you gave an interview for CBC Radio talking about being gay, talking about homophobia in sports. This is back in 93. But the two of you gave them anonymously. You gave your interview anonymously. Talk to me about why you chose to do that.
Oh, just for all the reasons I just really said, you know, 93. So I came out in 1998, which was still early, but 1993, there was just no space to do that. As a human being, I wasn't ready to speak publicly, openly. But I was happy to share my experience anonymously. I was terrified, by the way. I still remember hearing the they'd masked our voices, but I could still hear myself. And I was like, people will know it's me. I can hear myself in there. And having to change it again. And I'm still friends with the woman that was the executive producer and host of that show, two different people, Mary and Jennifer. But still there, that was such a significant moment for all of us. And we were really risking something, but it was a topic that needed to be talked about.
In 2009, Marc Leduc passed away. Did you know Marc Leduc at all?
I did as well, from that shared experience of doing the CBC radio show. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I didn't know him before. I mean, I knew him he stood out, you know, boxers. There's not that many of them usually on the team. And I knew Marc from the Olympic Village. Of course, we didn't know each other or gay until we did the radio thing. And then I would see him around the community in Toronto for sure for many years to come.
So in 1998, you officially came out, and on one hand, you came out. On another hand, you lost a six-figure motivational speaking contract.
I lost the contract because they thought I was too gay, and I wasn't openly gay yet. And so it made me go, you know what? screw it. If I'm being punished and I'm not even out, I may as well be out. Like, why am I putting myself through the torture of hiding? If even if I'm hiding, I'm going to lose stuff. So, so that was that. And it was interesting. It was from by another gay man. And in those days, it was like sometimes a woman would hold back another woman from the C-suite because they wanted to keep it for themselves. Sometimes gay men would discriminate against other gay people because they didn't want to be exposed for who they were. And so there was a lot of interesting dynamics going on. But I remember I was hired for some gigs and very close friends had me for lunch and actually said to me, I'm so sorry. But with your news, we can't move forward. And it was devastating. And it did make me have to really go back to who I was. But there was such an empowerment of like losing that secret. It would take years to fully heal. And, you know, the trauma of growing up gay and all that shit going on back in those days. But it was definitely freeing. And the connectivity to who I felt as an authentic person really helped me through that time, no matter how difficult the outside financial material losses might have been.
Things have gotten better, but do you think they've gotten to the place where they should be?
Oh, well, I think there's still a long way to go, but I do feel like we're living through a bit of an interesting tipping point. So I started for fun a little show called Queer Queries on the Mark Tewksbury YouTube channel, and I would tackle questions, and suddenly it was like, who is the first openly gay NFL contracted player? Who was the first openly gay NHL contracted player? Who was the first Major League Baseball? Like, there's all these breakthroughs in sport, and in fact, you know, when some of those players came out, their jerseys went on to be like the number one selling jerseys the following week. So I definitely think it's changed. I think the paradigm has shifted. I think that lots of brands actually love the idea of somebody being authentic and who they are. They're looking to diversify their audiences from the traditional, whatever sport audience they might have had. And I think having an openly LGBTQ plus person on your team actually speaks to new people and people actually see it as a huge opportunity, not the liability it used to be seen in my era.
After your Barcelona games in 92, you retired from swimming. Do you still swim?
I don't. No, I haven't really been a swimmer since 1992.
Really?
Yeah, no, swimming, I love to run and bike and ski and do all sorts of other sports, but I really had swum myself out, especially smell of chlorine. So like if I'm on holiday in Barcelona or in, you know, near the Mediterranean, love to swim in a body of water, a lake, an ocean, but the smell of chlorine and doing that for training, it just wasn't something that really ever appealed to me. Lots of my teammates are still swimming masters, but that just wasn't my trajectory at all.
So we will never see Mark Tewksbury near a pool.
Not anytime soon. Unless I'm suntanning.
You've accomplished a lot in your life. You've made history. You've won gold medals. You're on the cover of Time magazine. But for you, what are you most proud of?
I would say my relationship with my partner, Rob, is coming up to, you know, we're past 13 years into our 14th year. And it's just made me so happy. And I can see that I really, like, we just make each other's really the best we can be. And I love being able to do that for somebody and then in return, feeling how I feel.
How did you guys meet?
You know, our lives, it's one of those kind of semi-fated things. Our lives intersected a couple of times. One when I was 24, didn't work out. He was in a relationship. Next when I was 32, didn't work out. I wasn't living in Calgary. And then 48 years later, three different people in my life said, you got to meet this guy. You got to meet this guy. And I didn't realize it was him. And we got kind of set up on a blind date, a bit reluctantly with a friend that we share. I think he knew he was trying to keep us not together because he always wanted to have a great relationship. I think he was maybe envious of what would happen. But sure enough, we met on a Monday night, June 16th, 2008, and we've been together ever since. So it was a terrific blind date.
Wow. Wow.
It wasn't so blind. I walked in and went, oh, it's you.
Mark Tewksbury, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Mark. Keep up your great work. And hello, everybody out there. Goodbye, I guess.
That was my 2021 interview with recipient of the Order of Canada, public speaker, and of course, Olympic gold medalist, Mark Tewksbury. For even more, simply visit marktewksbury.org.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill. But without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, Poison, Corey Stewart.
Try to get inside my mind. Take a number, get in line. You're not the sharpest in the shed. All of the cards are in my deck. So play with someone else instead. Just thinking about this poison taking space up in my head. And I keep going back for more. You're not a friend, you're just a threat. Now you got me drinking, drinking, trying to forget, spending all my time rethinking, wishing you dropped it. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's my own fault, hit the asphalt, you're no longer by my side. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. Little baby, don't you sweat. How can I make sure your needs are met? Is there something I can get you? Just kidding. Drop dead. But who does all this punish? All this hate that's in my head. I wanna pin this all on you. You're not a friend, you're just a threat. Now you got me drinking, drinking, trying to forget, spending all my time rethinking, wishing you dropped it. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's my own fault, hit the asphalt, you're no longer by my side. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die.
You did the crime, did the time, you're like poison on my mind. Can't even think about the ways that you've been wasting all my time. Can't even think about the days that I would even call you mine. Can't even think about it, eh?
Self, self, cyanide.
Now I treat you like bleach. And my trust, you gon' breach. And I think about the ways you suck, suck like a leech. Draw a line in the sand, like a sign on the land. I'm divine at command. Go, understand.
It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die. It's like I drink the poison, wait for you to die.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Simone Denny, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with